for greenhouses and vertical farms. So while he was a PhD student, Nate started Bright Agritech. He subsequently did manage to complete his dissertation, and he has been running his company for about 5 years now. Is that right, Nate? And so he's going to talk to us about what he is doing with regard to developing production systems that can be used in vertical farming systems. Nate?
Great, thank you. Today I'm going to chat a little bit about vertical production systems, the systems that we design. And I'm going to really try and focus in on the problems that can be solved, I think, by academics and partnerships between academics and industry folks, because this is a very quickly growing industry. There will be a lot of turnover. There will be a lot of problems to be solved. So. I'll kick this off this is a picture of the pavilion wall in Milan. It's a 7,200 square foot vertical green wall, but it's using our equipment. So I put this up here because it's a great example. This is the largest food producing green wall in the world right now, and I think it's a great example of the direction that urban agriculture and urban farming is going, kind of a combination of the aesthetic with utility. And it's really kind of a beautiful idea. Let's see if I can work this here. So before I jump into this, this is a really quickly growing industry. This here is a map of our farmers. So we actively manage a network of farmers growing vertically using our equipment. These are all growers that are growing for commercial purposes. So they are in business, they are selling, they are operating their farms. And where they end up at really depends on a lot of different factors. It's a complicated thing. We've had to develop some very complicated Excel spreadsheets to determine where it's economic and where it's not, and to help our farmers make the best decisions. But it's really tied to geography, energy, technology, culture, and of course having a large population actually sell produce too. I'm going to also preface this presentation by eating a little crow and saying that 5 years ago I would have said that this isn't going to happen, right? It doesn't make sense. The economics don't work out. Replacing sunlight with artificial light is nonsensical. There are a lot of things here that are just ridiculous. And that was absolutely true about 5 years ago. But there has been a downward shift in the cost of LEDs. There have been all of these different market variables that have changed, cost of energy, access to systems that allow you to scale software, these types of things, have dramatically changed the equation, not everywhere, but in some places. And so I'm going to eat a little crow and say that 5 years ago I said this was crazy, and now a lot of my business is operating in this space, and we have an indoor farm as well. There is a lot of risk here. Still, it's a nascent industry. It's brand new, but it's growing. It's growing very quickly, and some people are finding some great success. I'll talk about a few farms a little bit later in the presentation, some farms that are in this space. So I wanted to jump right in here, too, and define vertical crop production as volumetric production as opposed to giant skyscrapers of food. And giant skyscrapers of food are certainly volumetric approach to plant production. However, economics don't work out right now. So what I'm talking about is a volumetric approach to farming. And we've been farming volumetrically for a long time. If you're a tomato producer, you farm volumetrically. If you're a cucumber producer or you produce any type of vining crop, you're already growing volumetrically on some scale because you're using greenhouse volumes as opposed to a single plane of production. So this is really what I'm talking about when I talk about vertical farming, and I found it useful to declare that on the front end because a lot of people always just assume I'm talking about skyscrapers of food. And they're cool, and I hope that we have them someday, but spending $1 billion on a farm equivalent to one section doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So there are two main forms out there right now. We concentrate on the true vertical or vertical plane farming, so farming on a vertical plane and allowing the plants to photo orient and orient in response to gravity. The other form, of course, is stratified horizontal, so this is just stacked layered kind of farm. techniques. They both work. And they're being done anywhere and everywhere. So people are starting farms on roofs. They're starting farms on the sides of buildings, like the pavilion photo you saw there. They're building these farms in warehouses, in warehouse space. They're building farms under buildings, you name it. Anywhere that the cost of real estate is relatively low, people are looking at the potential to grow there. So not all space is free, however. So free is not always free. And anyone who's retrofitted a warehouse for production knows that free isn't free. So there's a lot of buildings in Detroit that people will look at and say, oh, we've got all this free warehouse space, we should build here. No, you should not build there. A lot of these places, you have to do so much work to get it waterproofed and put in vapor barrier and put in floor drains and utilities, electrical service, that it's just not worth it. So anywhere that the cost is fairly low, people are growing, and they're growing all sorts of different crops. Now, mostly right now, everyone in this space is concentrated on really high-margin horticultural crops, so we're talking things like herbs and greens for the most part. These are also crops that suffer from extended distribution chains, so these are crops that maybe don't travel quite as well as, say, a tomato. The shelf life is relatively short, time to market has to be fast as soon as it's harvested, and the margins are quite high. When people ask me what I do, I say that I sell a little bit of carbon and a lot of water for a huge markup. And that's really what we do. There's a huge market for locally grown greens, locally grown culinary herbs. And this is huge. Now it's niche, right? And it allows the industry to survive right now because the industry is struggling to find how to be profitable, right? And it's easiest to be profitable with really high margin stuff. And so that's primarily where we're concentrated and where most of our customers and farmers are concentrated right now. But I anticipate that down the road, as the industry improves and grows, we're going to see a lot more people growing a diversity of crops indoors. And there are some that I'm just, pretty darn still convinced that they'll never be grown indoors, and certainly never profitably. But there are quite a few that can. So these farmers are selling to local wholesale primarily. There are some that are doing like regional wholesale and some that are doing national, that have their eyes on national wholesale markets. But by and large, they're pretty focused on local wholesale and local markets, and a lot of specialty retail work. So selling direct to consumers or selling, through live CSAs, home CSAs, and increasingly with some of the retail giants getting into direct delivery of produce, they're really kind of looking to these distributed producers to supply local markets with super hyper fresh, hyper local stuff. So, here's where I jump into kind of the problems, issues, and challenges with vertical growing or volumetric growing. I work with and consult with dozens of farms in the space, and so it's given me a great opportunity to see a lot of different problems, interesting things that people are doing, and really kind of understand the issues that come with this, because people have taken greenhouse production and just transported it into a warehouse space or what have you and assumed that all the variables stay the same, and nothing could be further from the truth. As soon as we transport this from the greenhouse environment or from the growth chamber, not at scale, to scale, everything changes. And so this is where most of the problems arise. And it doesn't help that many of the folks in this space are relatively new to growing, period. And so a lot of them don't have a history in greenhouse production. They don't understand ventilation issues. They don't understand how ventilation and CO2 enrichment interact, especially in the canopy. They don't understand how light application is important. And so when they put this production in a warehouse, a lot of the times it can mix up the variables to the extent that people really, really struggle for a long time with some of the design decisions they made on the front end. So this is a picture of some of our production orientations. We run, we tend to grow on the vertical plane, so we plant our crops in towers on these racks, and we move lights back and forth on robotic light movers. And we light them that way. And it works out for us most of the time. So the top of that is chopped off. But basically, this is just the space efficiency ratio. And I'm throwing this out there because everyone thinks the main problem with production in these spaces that we're trying to solve is lack of real estate, right? They think it's a real estate issue. How can we be as productive as possible per square foot? That's not the case. It never has been the case. The real problems are I'll address them a little bit later. But this is a big misnomer. And so I've got here several tiered. Most warehouses, standard warehouse height is usually around 24 feet tall. And so these are typically the head height that most people are working with on a typical warehouse. And this usually lends itself to, if we totally fill that warehouse up pretty efficiently and we're leaving enough room for a little air circulation, a little ventilation, that gives us about six tiers. Now, in all of my research and all of my numbers, you start losing money around tier four. So just because of the labor issue. So it's the cost of accessing those higher labor tiers that drives your labor costs up significantly. In fact, tier four is typically around the break-even point. So I've got here five tiers on a 4x8. Most growers tend to stick with like standard pallet rack sizes because a lot of them are using retrofitted pallet racks or maybe started their design with pallet racks, and they just kind of extrapolate those dimensions out as they scale. Or even if they change the design of their facility, they retain kind of these legacy dimensions. And so most folks are generally in this range. Sometimes they're a little bit, 5 foot wide, but typically like 4 to 5 foot wide, somewhere in there. And some of them will double up and go 8 foot wide. Well, the issues, you can see here, there's not a significant difference in space use between a five-tier 4 foot wide and a four-tier 8 foot wide. The space use efficiency is not significantly higher as a function of floor space, most of the time because you've got to have a minimum of 4 foot aisleways to get a scissor lift in there, which is how most of the maintenance and observation on the plant materials is done. So you've got to get a scissor lift in there, and so you have these set aisle widths. So this is kind of a typical space use efficiency measurement. It's very generic and it varies from place to place, but you're roughly, this is as a function of total floor space, this is roughly what you're looking at in terms of efficiency on a warehouse space. So these, you're looking at 2.5 times the floor space and production area with a five-tiered rack. You're looking at 2.7 with 8 foot wide four-tiered rack. And again, I'm with the 8x8, I'm not even going to go higher than that. It does bring it up above 3 if you go up to 5, and it goes a little higher with each one, but you're losing money at that point on labor, so it's kind of a nonsensical exercise, right? And then the way we do it is basically in these vertical racks, because our goal is that no one ever has to get in a scissor lift, because this is a huge safety. The labor problems with scissor lifts are just awful. And if anyone's ever used a scissor lift, you know what I'm talking about. But it's just not the most economical way to check on crops, as opposed to just walking through them. So these are kind of the three various forms that are out there in the market right now. The one on this side on the right is what I did all of my doctoral research on. And you see there's not a significant difference there. It's a little bit, but the differences are not huge. And what that really tells us is that when we're talking about this type of production, we need to be really careful that we're not overblowing the or overvaluing the space-saving aspects of it. Another issue that are not well addressed in most of these farms is air circulation and distribution. And so this is a huge problem in indoor growing spaces that most people don't clearly think about, and it affects a lot of things. Humidity, pest control issues, fungal issues, all of these things are directly related to air circulation. And with stratified models, the issue is that we have boundary layers now on the plant canopy and boundary layers on the bottom of the tier above it. And those boundary layers interfere with circulation in significant ways. It is very, very hard to get good circulation through these tiers without really extending them up. And every inch that we extend those tiers up, we start to lose value in terms of labor. So our labor costs rise. So this is a very delicate balance to walk between maintaining good circulation and ensuring that we're not, you know, blowing our labor costs way out of proportion in terms of monitoring crops, checking on them. And interestingly enough, if you ever have a chance to visit some of these farms, if you have a CO2 sensor with you, you can measure ambient CO2 in your aisleway on the edge of the production, and especially on the wider rack designs. If you stick that CO2 meter right in the middle of the growing tray, you'll see your CO2 is very low. So even if we're doing enrichment, a lot of the time we're wasting money unless we're getting good circulation and we're distributing that CO2 appropriately. In these farms, it is very difficult to distribute CO2 among these tiered layers with efficiency. Now, it can be done. You got to put in pipes. You got to put in basically distribution apparatus, and you can certainly do that. But it's certainly something that a lot of growers do not plan for adequately on the front end. On the vertical axis, it's a little bit easier to manage that kind of stuff, simply because you tend to have warm air from your light banks rising, so your light banks are actively heating the environments around them, and they're causing kind of this updraft. So if you design the facility in a way that kind of facilitates air movement on a vertical axis as opposed to a horizontal one, you're working with the heat from your lights, you're working with kind of a lot of your physics in a way that makes it a little bit easier. But you know, these are things that academia can look at and be like, well, yeah, of course. You know, we deal with this all the time in greenhouses. We deal with this all the time. We've been dealing with this for 50 years, 60 years, 70 years. This is an area where there's a lot of room to help out folks starting in this industry and to help them build facilities that are appropriate. So the biggie here, the elephant in the room, is always labor use efficiency with these things. And, you know, most of my research was back in the day was on labor use efficiency and what composition of the total product cost we're looking at in terms of labor. It's significant. It's more than 50% on average for most of these horticultural crops, cost to consumer. So a lot of the time we scrape away at these tiny things. Oh, we just try to produce more per square foot on the same margins. Or we try to reduce the cost of our nutrients, we try to reduce the cost of our CO2, we try to reduce the cost of our heating and cooling. But at the end of the day, we're talking about marginal increases in production, marginal increases in our cost efficiency. Really what we should be looking at is our labor use efficiency. And unfortunately, in many vertical farms, we're actually taking a step backwards in terms of labor use efficiency, primarily because of scissor lifts. Scissor lifts, I hate them, they're the worst. Most farms rely very heavily on scissor lifts for plant monitoring, harvesting, any type of work that needs to be done on these beds. And it is not safe, right? We are 20 feet up in the air in a moist, humid environment, typically poorly trained workers, right? This is like a recipe for disaster in these huge electronic machines. So there are a lot of things here where I feel like, especially in the realm of automation, automating these processes, that there's a lot of room for partnership, because all of this is about thinking about the problems in the most appropriate way and designing a solution. A lot of these solutions exist; they just don't have access to the information. So this is basically how we typically organize our facilities on a vertical axis. We concentrate on keeping people's feet on the ground. We don't like people to be up in the air. And if you kind of hack the traditional growing model and you think about the physics of it in some different ways, you can improve your efficiency typically and reduce those labor costs. And that's really what we're focused on. Oh, you guys have the graphic. It disappeared online. The energy use efficiency is always something that's brought up, and there's a lot of research right now on the lighting side of things. I will tell you right now, when you're growing intensively, you don't need to heat buildings. We build buildings, setups, above the Arctic Circle, and no heating costs. The lights are doing the heating, and this is with LEDs. Okay, this is with LEDs. And so we are talking about absolutely massive heat production, even in facilities where we're using exclusively LEDs, simply because of the amount of lighting that we have in the facility and the intensity that we're growing under. So we're almost always just talking about electricity, right? And then finding the balance between CO2 generation and our heat production and our dehumidification and kind of all of these variables, finding the right balance, and that all costs a lot of energy. So understanding your costs, understanding how you're managing your facility at, you know, peak times versus times when your rates drop, and basically just being clever and intelligent about your energy use is something that a lot of people need a lot of help with. And if you guys haven't kind of, you know, like figured out where I'm going with this now, what I'm saying is you guys need to like try and find growers in your areas and figure out how to partner with them, because there's a lot of room for research, but there's a lot of room for translating existing research into really positive outcomes for these growers, because a lot of them really don't know what they're doing. And this is it's going to be a fairly large industry. It really will. There are a lot of people that are going to make it and are going to do very well. And it's good to be working with them now. So these are some farms that we've worked with in the past, or you know, are customers of ours in some way, shape, or form. So the first one is Farm Here. They're a tiered farm. They're a stacked horizontal farm in Chicago, and they serve the Chicago area regional distribution. They are aquaponic, which is kind of interesting because my initial research was all in aquaponic, the use of fish waste in the hydroponic systems. It was super niche about 10 years ago. It still is super niche, but the interesting thing about aquaponics is it offers the ability to go organic with your hydroponic system in a way that reasonably won't be have you thrown out in 3 or 4 years. You're not going to lose your certification most likely with something like aquaponics, because it's integrated system and they tend to smile a little bit more on integrated systems like this. So it is an aquaponic system in Chicago, which is interesting. It introduces all sorts of challenges growing aquaponically. Now you're dealing with three different things, trying to keep three different variables alive instead of just focusing on plants. But they do pretty well with it. They do mostly microgreens and basil. Again, relatively high value horticultural crops. And Chicago's a large market, and so it can certainly absorb their production, and they're scaling and distributing regionally as well. This is a vertical tower production facility. This is a facility in Berkeley, California. They Local Greens, they're one of our customers. We work with them quite closely. They grow in a warehouse environment right behind Whole Foods, and they do quite well. They discovered that the demand for hyper-local stuff there is so high, they get cleaned out pretty quickly. Their distribution model is really, we harvest, process it, put it on a cart, a guy wheels it down the sidewalk, around the corner, into the Whole Foods, and puts it on the shelf. That's how close they are. It is like, you know, the food miles is, you know, like 250 food feet. When it's all said and done, which of course, you know, offers a really unique opportunity for them to, you know, market. A lot of people will say, oh, well, they save a lot of money on distribution. Well, not really. I mean, we're good at distribution, right? But what they really what it allows them to do is sell a hyper-local product, and people are even more excited about paying an extra 15 cents or 50 cents or $2 for something that's hyper-local over something that, you know, even just came a few miles. So they're doing some very interesting work with microgreens and basil. This is the Pavilion Project in Milan. The brown stuff up there are ripening grains, by the way. They're not, you know, they're intentionally kind of dead. The goal here, I wish I was smart enough to embed an actual video in the display, because these are all on articulating panels that swing out and shut. And the architect, when he first came to me with this idea, was like, we can maximize our sunlight use. And I was like, no, the physics don't work out. It doesn't do anything for you to have these panels opening and closing. But he's like, well, it'll look cool. I was like, that's legitimate. So So he put in these articulating panels, and it's really beautiful. They move up and down the building in waves, and they kind of open and close like gills. It's like the building is breathing. It's really beautiful. It's a really beautiful blend of the functional, kind of the horticultural sciences, and the architectural sciences. And it's really, really marvelous to see. There's videos of it online, and if you plan on going to Milan this fall, definitely check it out. Because I know everyone here is probably planning on a little Milan trip. Another example here is of modular farms, and this is an area that's really blowing up because everyone's trying to figure out how they can get at a very small scale into farming specialty crops for really high value markets. And this particular form is offering people the opportunity to do just that. So this is a picture of vertical plane production in these freight farm containers. They use our product as well, and there are of course a lot of issues that come with trying to condense production down into this tight environment. However, they're all things that we can eliminate by design and engineering. And so, again, another very ripe area for collaboration. So, where this industry needs help, it's not just on the equipment design side. My company really focuses on equipment design, model design, and increasingly software. And we really just dig into kind of the distributed model. Like, what does this look like if at a distributed, taking these very condensed, very concentrated type of production centers, breaking them down, distributing them out over the landscape, and how do we help people organize? How do we disseminate information? How do we make sure that everyone is operating under the optimal model? These are the areas that we kind of focus on. But you'd be amazed at how often I tell people, hey, listen, dude, don't even talk to me. Go find your local extension agent and have this conversation with them. So if you guys start having tons of people show up at your doorstep, I'm sure you already do with plant samples, tissue samples, water samples, that kind of thing. It may be partially my fault. But this is something that most people don't think about, is utilizing local university resources, that type of thing, and using them appropriately in these startup farms. So there's a lot of growth chamber research, and really what we're doing is growth chambers at scale. That's what almost all of these things are, is growth chambers at scale. So there's a lot of room for to take existing research and existing understanding of how growth chambers work, and how we basically use growth chambers and scaling those out to some level to answer some of these questions. Of course, hydroponic production research, there's a lot of information that people lack in regards to solution management, and pest control, all of these different things. A lot of them rely entirely on exclusion, which is, that's a solution with a timeline. The problem with exclusion is that when it does fail, it can be very difficult to catch up. So talking about pest management, that kind of thing, is always a very useful thing. So some of these are very generalist type things. Some of them are specific to individual farms. But by and large, there's a role that academia can certainly play in assisting this industry as it gets off the ground. And so the last kind of thought that I want to leave with is that 99% of the problems, after we've solved all the simple stuff, will relate to labor, almost always relates to labor. So this is where almost everyone who's doing really interesting and innovative things in this space, this is where they're focusing. And this is really an area that they lack, because they haven't, a lot of these growers, they aren't traditional greenhouse growers, they haven't been in the industry for very long, and they're unfamiliar with all of the issues historically in the industry, and kind of what the context for this modern new type of production is. And history repeats itself again and again and again. History always repeats itself. And so looking at this, we know that the future really lies in automation and developing that equipment. So where there is room for collaboration, primarily in metrics, analyses, equipment, consulting, these types of things. And of course, the publication dissemination of information helps to legitimize the industry. Right now, there's kind of this black cloud that constantly hangs over it. A lot of people look at the indoor production industry and say, it's unproven, it's crazy, it's nonsense, blah, blah, blah. I would have said, 10 years ago, absolutely. That's absolutely true. But variables are changing very rapidly. The cost of LEDs is coming down. Culture is shifting over to this like hyper-local mentality. Local is better. I'll pay a dollar more for my basil if it was grown 250 feet from here than if it was grown 6 miles from here. And that's a significant change. Significant change in how people view these products. So there's a lot of room here for publication, research, and of course, this will all serve to legitimize the industry as it grows. And it's growing. It's growing very quickly. It's most likely not going to slow down. Venture capital investment into this industry is like, I think, 3 times year to date what it was all of last year. So we're sitting at massive capital infusions. There's massive capital infusions taking place right now when it comes to just this general research area. There's a lot of money there, and there's no reason why some of it shouldn't be devoted to these partnerships and this type of research. So that's all I've got for you.
Do we have questions for me?
Yes.
Have there been any observations yet about outdoor air quality in urban areas becoming limiting to indoor agriculture involving the ventilation or HVAC system?
Specifically, no. No, not to my knowledge. Most of the research that has been done is in the landscape architecture, in the realm of landscape architecture, where they're looking at basically using plants and devices like, our towers and green wall applications, that type of thing, for remediating urban air quality. That's about the extent of it. No one's really clearly looked at the effects on indoor ag. I mean, I know that there have been studies done on, agriculture along highways and interstates and how, CO2 and carbon monoxide and lead back in the 50s, before when gasoline was leaded. There's a lot of research on that, but there is not to my knowledge, any information out there or any research on urban air quality and how it affects these operations, no. I mean, we know we've got elevated CO2 levels, and that doesn't hurt, but as far as everything else in the air, who knows? Who knows? It's a concern. It certainly is a concern. Yes? Yeah, right now it's being treated basically as controlled environment, as a controlled environment application like greenhouses, same category. I don't think it's big enough that it warrants anyone's attention yet. I think that's really it, is there's just not that many operations in comparison to, greenhouses that anyone's looked at it too closely. But there will be soon, I'm sure. And there should be, because the application of insecticides, inside of a confined space like this, you'd think it's the same as in a greenhouse, but it's really not. There are a lot of big differences, right? And in a lot of ways, it's not just, how it's applied and, food safety kind of stuff, but also in regards to human health and safety, because it's a very different kind of environment. Yes. Sure. Yeah, so in the landscape design space, trellis systems and kind of facade systems where they're actually simplified from an engineering standpoint. It's like a traditional tomato greenhouse where you have, a single point, the plant is growing from this point, and then we train the vines in a way that, maximizes the use of vertical space. And that's actually, it's beautiful and it works. Great, yeah. But it's crop specific. Yes?
What if you can speak to the practicality of the Moulin wall? It's beautiful and everything, but is that actually feasible, and is it economically possible to harvest food all the way up there?
Sure. Yeah. I got to watch what I say here. The Milan Wall is gorgeous, and it is producing food. And as far as I know, they are using that food in the food trucks. Now, whether the economics work out, that's a totally different thing. And it was a struggle for me because I'm a farmer first and then kind of second interested in the aesthetics, right? I come from a functional background. And so when I first started getting together with the architects who were very generous and humored me, really, really humored me. I said things like, okay, we'll design this so the towers can be pulled from the backside, harvested from behind, from inside the structure, so we don't have to use anything on the outside. We'll do this. Like, I designed it for utility, just pure utility. And basically the architect said, well, that's nice and all, but the primary concern is the aesthetic. And so it was a very interesting exercise for me to go through this exercise where I took utility and sacrificed it on the altar to aesthetics. And it was a valuable exercise. It was a great exercise in working with someone from a completely different discipline to build something that was beautiful first and foremost. It is producing food. I mean, like the grains that you saw up there, of course, they're not going to harvest the grains and thresh the grains and grind the grains and bake bread out of them, most likely. They are growing. I know they're growing a lot of vegetable crops that last time I heard they were actually using in the food trucks. So the economics of it, I'm sure it's the most expensive head of lettuce ever. But all of these things kind of start that way, right? I mean, we start at the lowest tier of economic feasibility, and we work our way up. And that's really the only way to do it. So even though I feel a little bit crazy sometimes, with like the economics of certain operations as we're working on these things, the reality is all this industry starts in a place where the economics are a big question mark. And then by, working on these efficiencies, working on markets, working on models, working on data, working on all of these different things, we're able to iron out some of the details and make it a little bit more clear. I don't know who was first. Yes.
Do you have any issues with irrigation?
What do you mean?
Well, how are you irrigating?
So in our systems, we irrigate constant flow. It's just a pretty traditional hydroponic sump and mixing tank system, auto-dosing, all that stuff. And like for ours, we do quick racks, modular racks, so our racks actually roll around the greenhouse. We manage produce by the rack. And so they snap in, they snap out of the irrigation system and the drainage system, yeah. And they go right to market sometimes. So it can be an issue. The big thing with irrigation, of course, is how it impacts humidity and just basically the engineering the layout in a way that doesn't get overly complicated. You're not relying on too many pumps. You don't have too many failure points. You have redundancy. It's just kind of like standard engineering stuff, but by and large, we don't have too many issues with irrigation. In some ways, it's a lot easier indoors than anywhere else.
What's the most common insect and disease pests that you've encountered, and how do you control them?
Oh, good night. Do I have like an hour?
Is that most common?
Oh, most common. For most of our growers, aphids are always a struggle. I mean, it's kind of always the big three: thrips, aphid, whitefly, and fungus gnats. In many operations, can be an issue. Interestingly enough, in indoor application, drain flies. While they're not, necessarily, they don't impact the health of the crop at all. They do impact the quality of the produce, and most operations will have drain flies at some point in time. They live in every drain. You just don't notice it until you're growing and you turn your entire warehouse into a giant drain, or the equivalent of a giant drain, and then your fungus gnats your drain flies get very excited and go bonkers and have lots of children. So aphids are probably the biggie. It depends. Different operations really struggle with different things, and a lot of that relates to just, I think, the genetic diversity among pest populations. Some of them just really take to certain environments, and some of them don't. As you were saying, some pests show up, and thrips, whether it's breaking the life cycle with light dark cycle or what have you. There are ways kind of to deal with some of these things, but it really is highly variable. What's that?
Diseases,
powdery mildew is very common. Downy has shown up in some operations, especially with basil production, and a lot of that is because they're just pulling in outside air, and I'm convinced that a lot of the time it's just a random spore. It's blown for 100 miles. It just makes its way in. We have, besides that, gray molds can be a little bit of an issue just because people do struggle with their humidity oftentimes. If they're doing CO2 enrichment, then they start thinking, oh, my CO2 is worth a lot of money. I don't want to dump it with ventilation, so they're not controlling their humidity appropriately, and you end up with mostly gray molds besides that. So, powdery is probably the most common of everything, though. And a lot of that has to do with just ventilation issues and humidity control. Yeah.
You mentioned at the beginning that some areas here in the U.S. it makes sense, and some areas does not make sense because of probably
right.
Economic. So my question is that possible to identify one single factor that allows economic feasibility, like energy or labor or maybe the other food supply around, or each place
Each place is different, and it's very difficult to nail down. I mean, I could just throw it out at you and say demographic and population and market size. I mean, that's always going to be like your starting point. It doesn't matter what you can produce if you can't sell it. Starting backwards at every point in the production and distribution chain, there is one major hurdle, right? So the first one is just market. Do we have market for it? And then you kind of work your way back. Do we have access to labor? Or do we have access to real estate? It just totally depends on the place. And I will say for most indoor operations, a lot of it comes down to electrical use and the cost of electricity. Cost of electricity is a big deal. Not as big a deal as labor use, but it is a big deal. It's an opportunity cost calculation. At the end of the day, what I end up doing most of the time is we do a massive spreadsheet that compares production in a greenhouse to production indoors. And we look at the opportunity cost of doing it one way or the other. And at the end of the day, that comparison usually tells us the truth, right? It's not usually a question of just raw economics. Can we be in the black with this? It's about, can we be in the black with a competitor in the greenhouse space? Or can a greenhouse producer be in the black with a competitor in the warehouse space? So it's a competitive question at the end of the day. And it requires running all of those calculations side by side. And so there are a lot of people that come to us and want to buy our equipment and want to do like an indoor thing, and we say, don't do it. You're going to lose money. And there are some people that come to us and they say, I want to put your equipment in a greenhouse. And we say, okay, but here's what it looks like if Joe Schmo moves in next door to you and starts doing this in a warehouse. Given your location, given your market, given your demographic, given your cost of electricity, given your insurance costs, given your lease arrangements, given the all of these other variables, your climate, he can outcompete you by 3 cents a head of lettuce or what have you. So it's a competitive question at the end of the day. That's probably the thing that drives me the craziest about the industry, is they all think it's just an issue of can we produce it. Growing stuff is easy. Growing stuff is easy. Anyone can grow stuff. It's a question of whether the guy next door can grow it for cheaper than you, and in the same kind of product category. So,
thank you, Nate. For the sake of time, we'll move on to the next speaker. We have more time for questions later. Thank you very much.